Tell me about you, Ken Follow. I know you were born in England. Tell me about the circumstances of your birth and early childhood.
I was born in, not in England, but in Wales, in the capital city, which is Cardiff. And my father works for the tax people, worked then and still does work for the tax people in England. And I went to state schools and had a relatively routine upbringing, with the exception that we never had a TV in our home. Consequently, my entertainment was reading rather than TV.
What did you like to read?
Well, what I like to read now, adventure stories and space stories.
Did you went on to college?
Yes, I went to London University, took a degree in philosophy, mm-hmm. and then became a newspaper reporter.
Where did you work?
I worked on two newspapers, first back in my hometown of Cardiff, on the South Wales Echo, and then in London on the London Evening News.
So you got off to a relatively early start writing, at least writing nonfiction.
That's right, yes. I wanted to be a hotshot reporter. I didn't become that. I was never that good as a reporter.
Don't we all?
Okay.
You had written a number of books prior to your first one, Eye of a Needle. I understand, in reading some of the biographical material that was sent by Morrow, many of these books were written with pseudonyms, I guess.
Yeah.
Tell me about those books.
Well, when my first novel was accepted for publication, my agent suggested that I might one day want to write better books, and so she suggested that I have a pen name for that first book. It was a sensational mystery with a lot of fast cars and fast women. From that beginning, I sort of, my books improved a little. I wrote 10 altogether.
Under what name?
Well, that first one I called myself Simon Miles, but I was also Zachary Stone and Bernard L. Ross and Martin Martinson and others I've forgotten. I wrote them very fast. One time I was writing 4 a year. Although I didn't spend enough time on them, and in the end they weren't very good, they got a little better. Each was a little better than the last. And I learned from them. Each one I intended to be the breakthrough bestseller, and as one by one they were published and failed to become bestsellers, I tried to analyze what there was about them that wasn't sufficiently appealing or wasn't sufficiently high quality. And finally, with Eye of the Needle, as I was writing it, I felt that I'd done it. Whatever it was, I had solved the problem.
Were these early books of yours in paper? Did they come out in paperback?
Some were paperback originals, yes. The first one was a paperback original. Some were published in hardcovers.
Was Eye of the Needle accidentally a good book? You say you were in the middle of writing it when you realized that there was a different quality to this book than the others.
It certainly wasn't anything like an accident, no. It was all very deliberate. And but there was a feel to the book, to Eye of the Needle, that I sensed as I was writing it. I was very careful to create the right characters and to plot the thing right and pace it right. And the structure of Eye of the Needle, the reader doesn't generally notice it, but it has a very rigid structure, that book. And also all that was very deliberate and very carefully done. And out of all that contrivance came a real feel of pace and panic. And that's what I felt. That's when I said to my wife, this is a terrific book I'm writing.
So you had a very good comprehension of the quality of the book and probably an inkling that it was going to sell pretty well.
Yes, I knew it would sell well. I must say I did not anticipate that it would sell millions and millions, but I knew it would be a successful book, a bestseller.
These earlier books under the pseudonyms, were they selling sufficiently to provide an income for you?
No, I wasn't living on them, except at the... Well, no, I never lived on those books. They supplemented my income as a reporter. And I also quit the newspaper business and went to work for a publisher at some point during this, while I was writing these books. And they supplemented my income. And I wrote Eye of the Needle while I was still working for the publisher. And then quit when I had finished it. Mainly because I knew that this book would provide me with enough money to live on for at least a year.
What did you do over that year?
Well, I began work on Triple. I also did some, I suppose you could call it, hack work. I wrote a novel for an English publisher based on the screenplay for the movie Capricorn One. I wrote a giant ape story for a publisher who was negotiating for the rights to King Kong, but was not sure that he would get them. So he wanted to have a giant ape story in case.
Did that ever come out?
I think it was published, yes.
Not under the name Ken Follett.
No, it's indeed not. And I'm not sure I'm going to tell you what name.
All right.
I wrote a television show, an episode of an English cop show for the BBC, that kind of work.
Before we get to On Wings of Eagles, a couple of more questions. Where do you... I know that you live... You have an apartment here in New York.
Yes.
Where is that located?
In the Village. I have a loft in the Village.
But you live most of the time in Cardiff?
No, in Surrey, about 50 miles from London.
Mm-hmm. Where do you do most of your writing?
Well, in my house we have a library. It's on the top floor. It's on the attic floor. And when we bought the house, there were 5 bedrooms there for maids. And we knocked all the walls down and turned that into a library. So it's a library in the roof, and it has windows out onto my garden, which is very beautiful. And it's furnished with mahogany shelves and a light-coloured carpet, and it's just a beautiful place to work, very quiet and peaceful, surrounded by my books. That's where I work.
Eye of the Needle did all right for you.
It certainly did.
Plus the Greenwich Village apartment, which is probably... Is it difficult to maintain an apartment in New York while you live in Surrey?
Oh, well, it has its problems. Things break down and I'm not there to get them fixed. But it's wonderful to have, instead of staying in hotels here, to have a real home here.
Is it empty during the time you're there? Do you sublet it?
No, I don't sublet it, no. I'm here a lot. I spend a lot of time in New York City.
What do you do when you're here in New York?
Well, I mainly talk to my editor and my agent and do business, mm-hmm. discuss future books. My books are... to some extent a collaborative effort. I seek input and criticism from large numbers of people, and I'm fortunate in having an agent who is a very creative man, who has in fact made his living as a writer, and I have some good editors also. So I show them drafts of my outlines and drafts of my manuscripts and so on. So we have a lot of creative meetings here.
Your books are so popular in the United States, I don't believe that you are perceived of as being a British writer, but just a writer, because your books have had a relatively universal appeal, I believe. When you write, do you write them as a British person, for example, using British idioms and spellings and the sort of thing, and then change them for an American public, or are they the same books?
The only difference is that, I use English-type spellings and phrases, and then for the U.S. edition, my editor just changes petrol to gasoline and lorry to truck and alters the spellings. I've deliberately avoided writing a novel with American characters simply because if I write about British characters, I can freely invent their background, their childhood, their school, their food, their landscapes. Whereas if I wrote American characters, I would have to research those things, and I wouldn't get the same natural feel. So I've always been frightened to do a real American story. In fact, I've always suspected it couldn't be done, but Jeffrey Archer's done it, and done it very successfully.
I was going to say, but he has used a couple of basic books... but he was here a little while ago, and...
Did you talk to him?
Yes.
Uh-huh,
he was
good.
Here when he was promoting The Prodigal Daughter, which, as you may recall, is about the woman that becomes president of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
But he had a couple of books by American authors that set a tone for him, that gave him a lot of background. Many of them were novels, and he lifted relatively freely to create his characters. Mm-hmm. And he similarly has an editor in the United States who changes the words and the spellings and this sort of thing. As I read on Wings of Eagles, of course, it seemed a very American-type book. You must have spent a lot of time in Dallas, is that right?
Oh, yes, indeed, yes. Many weeks, many hours and days of interviews. And, of course, this is a complete... On Wings of Eagles is a completely American story, but nothing's made up. I wasn't required to invent anything. I had to get all that detail, all that background, all that stuff about childhoods and so on. I was going to have to research anyway, so it made no difference.
What was Dallas like for you? Was it a cultural shock?
No, it's not. I suppose one's first impression, and this would apply to New Yorkers going to Dallas as well as to Europeans going to Dallas, one's first impression is of incredible prosperity. As you drive into Dallas from the airport, you know the drive from the airport to downtown in most cities, you see good and bad. You see shanty towns and you see billboards and auto repair shops on the side of the road. You drive into Dallas, it's just like driving through a manicured industrial park. Beautiful architecture, beautiful buildings going up everywhere. All the lawns are watered, all the trees are cared for. The place just reeks of money. It's kind of nice. I mean, there are not many places in the world today that are that prosperous.
Well, places like Dallas and Houston, they can do that. There was nothing there. Houston, a city I know pretty well, it's a brand new city because there was nothing there. There was just fields and plains. So mm-hmm. All of a sudden they could put a brand new building. You'll be driving on a freeway and all of a sudden you'll see a 40-story building sticking out of nowhere like a needle. And around it, again, the manicured lawns and everything. Mm-hmm. But they didn't have to tear down anything.
Oh, quite all right, yeah.
In New York, if you're familiar with any of the politics in the city, there is a tremendous hue and cry over the building of an expressway called Westway on the west side along the Hudson River. To do it, many buildings have to be torn down, and existing roadways changed, and tunnels. It not only is it very expensive, but it dislocates many people.
Mm-hmm.
This is not the case in Texas
and
Dallas, where you can just, you want to build something, build it, and it's brand new.
Sure.
How did you get the... Why did you do On Wings of Eagles? Was this your idea? Did Ross Perot go to you?
No, they came to me and said they wanted somebody to do the story, and I did
Who? Who came to you?
EDS Corporation, which is the company owned by Perot, wrote to me, or rather wrote to my agent. And I decided to do it because I liked the story. I get a lot of letters like that, I should tell you. About every week or every couple of weeks, a letter comes from somebody saying, I've been involved in an adventure. I think it would make the basis of a great Ken Follett novel, or I think it would think you are the person to tell my true story. And this is the first time I've ever even followed up on one of those letters. It was obviously different, first of all, because it didn't come from crazy people, and many of these come from crazy people. Perot was evidently a rather interesting character. There was a larger-than-life major character in it from the start. It was Dallas, which interested me from afar, even before I ever visited the place. I had the feeling that Dallas would be a fascinating locale for a book. And as I learned a bit more about the story, I discovered that it's a story that's long enough for a book, and that's not true of many of these stories. This kind of thing, often there just isn't enough in it for a whole book. It might make a good, say, newspaper article or an extended piece in a magazine that does extended pieces like the New Yorker. But this was complex enough, and complex in an intriguing way, to be 120,000, 130,000 words.
Did after you became excited with the idea, did you fly into Dallas to meet Perot? How did this initial contact work out?
Yes, I went to Dallas, went there in the morning, came back in the evening. My first meeting with Perot, spent half a day with him,
What was that meeting like?
Well, I was pretty wary of Perrault, and he spent most of his time telling me anecdotes. And they were pretty funny. He's a pretty funny guy. I suppose, in a way, for me at that point, that was his saving grace, because in other respects, we had nothing in common. There were different nationalities, different generations, different politics, and he's from business and I'm from the arts. So we really had nothing in common, but he made me laugh, and I like people who make me laugh.
Was the Perrault's idea initially to commission the book, or would he be satisfied, or was he satisfied with having it published, written and published independently?
I don't know what was in his mind, because I knew from the start the way I wanted to do it, and there was never any question of doing it any other way. The way I wanted to do it was as follows. He would cooperate with me in obtaining the information, and I would do a deal with my publishers which would have nothing to do with Ross Perrault. In other words, I wrote a book and sold it to my publishers in the normal way.
So there was no editorial control on the part of Perrault?
Yes, there was. He had the following editorial control. He was concerned to protect the memory of Carl Simons, who is the hero of the story and who is now dead. And we agreed that if my characterization of Colonel Simons was radically different from what Perrault saw as the character of Colonel Simons, then the book would not be published. That was our deal. And indeed, I agreed to it because I was fairly sure it wouldn't happen, and he was fairly sure it wouldn't happen, and indeed it didn't.
Was he afraid that you were not going to like Simons?
Yes, that's what he was afraid of. As I say, it didn't happen.
What happened next? You decided to go ahead. You spent a long time in Dallas. Did you stay at a hotel in Dallas or rent an apartment, or how did that...
I stayed at hotels, yeah.
Did Perrault give you then a cast of characters of all of the many people involved in this?
Yes. My first interview was with him to get the broad outline of the story. Then all the people in the story, each of the people in the story wrote an account of the section of the story with which he was most intimately familiar. So I began with a series of memoranda from characters in the story telling me their bit, and I then interviewed them. And that was the beginning of a long process. I would interview them, my interviews would be transcribed, I would read the transcripts and think of more questions, note more questions, interview them again, take all the information away. I wrote a draft, I showed the draft to all the main characters. And of course, while I was writing the draft, I thought of more questions, which I noted down. They would read the draft and again write me a memo with corrections for accuracy and suggestions, alternative interpretations, change of emphasis, and additions. I specifically asked them for additional detail, stuff they had forgotten to tell me first time round. Then with all that information in front of me, I would interview them again, and we'd go through the whole process again. Took four drafts.
Did any of the characters involved challenge your dialogue?
Oh, yes, that happened frequently. And, of course, I would change it.
They would say, I just didn't say that.
Yes, or they would say, that isn't the type of phrase I would use. I've said, in the preface to the book, I've said that there are two things that aren't completely faithful to the truth. One is the dialogue, because real-life dialogue just cannot be written down. And I discovered this because I did actually have transcripts of tape recordings of some of the conversations in this book. And when I tried to put those down, absolutely verbatim, they just didn't make sense. So that at that point I gave up trying to put in real-life dialogue and accepted that dialogue has to be edited and reconstructed. So all the dialogue in the book is reconstructed, but they have indeed many times have said to me, oh no, I don't use the word heck, for example. I would say, gosh.
I assume that would have been an impossibility to go to Iran itself.
I considered it and decided that it wasn't worth risking my life. So we see on Wings of Eagles, we see Iran, we see the landscape and the cities and so on through the eyes of the characters, Jay Coburn and Joe Poche and Ross Perrault and all those people, because I asked them they would be talking about going to a particular street, and I would say, okay, what did it look like? How wide was the street? Were there any trees? What were the buildings made of? How many people were there? What was the weather like? Was it hot or cold? Was the sun shining? So it is not my description of Iran, it's Jacobin's description.
Well, I'll tell you, it's a harrowing story that it should have been fiction. It's almost unbelievable that people had... I think the trip up the highway to the Turkish border, where there were constant halts at roadblocks,
yeah,
you just couldn't... And then, even afterward, after flying through, going through Turkish customs, and even stopping in Germany, and then the incident at the London airport, it just seemed as though it never stopped.
Right.
I'm very glad you have an epilogue in the back saying what happened to everybody. That was very helpful. Your overall conclusion with Ross Perot and his people, what do you think about them after you have put all of these words together and talked to all of these people? What kind of people are they in your mind?
Well, Perot himself, excuse me, Perot himself is a remarkable man, and I think he's a good man. I hate to admit it of a conservative, but I have great admiration for him. And that particular group of people, really what makes this a story worth telling, they're a group of people with qualities of loyalty and courage which are really admirable. Now, they're not saints, and I've tried not to portray them as saints, but I have portrayed them as good people. I'm getting a little bit of criticism in the reviews for liking my characters too much, but that's just too bad. I like those people, and so...
It's an unusual EDS is unusual. The loyalty that Perot either achieved or demanded is something that is not normally found, is it?
He's unusual. I think the rest of the people in the story are fairly ordinary people whose good qualities have been brought out by what happened in the story. They rose to a challenge, as I think many ordinary Americans or indeed Europeans would. Perot is not an ordinary person. He's an extraordinary person. And he wins their loyalty by the kind of man he is. And I describe in the book, we take as an example Jacobin, who's the main character in the book. And I tell in the book how Ross Perot won Coburn's undying loyalty. And basically, Perot saved the life of Coburn's son. But Perot does that kind of thing every week, and that's why he has a group of people around him who are loyal to him in rather a striking fashion. They're also not afraid to criticize him, which is, to me, very interesting thing.
I noticed they would talk back to him in the book.
Yeah, and any head of a corporation can get people scared of him, but to get people to love him is another achievement entirely. I was with one of the rescue team last week, and we were in a concert hall and looking for the way out, and I said, is that it over there? Oh no, that's a phone booth. And the guy said, yes, that's where Ross changes.
Two final questions. You mentioned the phone booth. Have you been back for a barbecue? Has Ross invited you over for dinner or anything like that since the publication of the book?
Well, we had a big party in Dallas last week, the day before the Texas publication date, and I gave a dinner party for all the people who had helped me with the book by giving me interviews. So we had a good time.
What, based on all of the interviews you did, all of your research, and all the words that you wrote, how do you feel about the Iranians?
About the Iranians? Well, it's pretty clear that we all completely misunderstood those people and that country and what was happening. We all thought that there was a revolution going on, but we When we say revolution, we think of the revolutions in our own history. We think of the American Revolution and the French Revolution, the Russian Revolution, and the English Revolution, which in our English way we call the Civil War, because we don't like to think that we have revolutions. And we expected their revolution to follow that pattern, and of course it didn't. It had absolutely nothing to do with anything that's ever happened in American and European history. And so we all misunderstood it. And that's the beginning, to realize that is the beginning of wisdom. And I think we've now realized our ignorance. Okay, so we know now that we don't understand them, and that's the beginning of the road towards understanding them.
Well, carry that a step further. We don't understand them, but why don't we understand them, and what are they? Why did they do what they did in the most vivid, outrageous way? Now, there were a couple of Iranian heroes, Rashid, for example, but even they were few and far between.
Yes, and even Rashid, who is a hero in this story, is a character who's somewhat difficult to understand. As you read on Wings of Eagles, you don't know what Rashid is going to do next, and that's because nobody knew what Rashid was going to do next. He was his own man. He marched to his own drummer. And in a way, although he helped Americans, and the Iranian government in general did not help Americans, Rashid is nevertheless typically Iranian, because we can't account for his behavior. We couldn't predict his behavior.
You can't make any judgments about the Iranians, then, because you alluded a moment ago to the fact that they are too difficult to understand.
Yes, I don't think we can make any judgments about them at this stage. We can make judgments about ourselves. It was your government and my government who put the Shah in power and kept him there all those years while he tortured and murdered all those people, and we both live in democracy, so it's you and me who are responsible for that. We can make judgments about ourselves, but about them, no, I don't think so.
So Ken Follett's not going to sit there and say, this is a fanatical, outrageous people committing anarchy. You won't make any condemnation of the Iranians, although it seems to come through in the book in so many ways, but you're not prepared
to
state it.
Well, all right. They treated these people very badly indeed. It was grossly unjust. Well, jailing Paul and Bill was grossly unjust. There was no due process, and they were innocent, decent men, and they were thrown in jail, and that's disgraceful. So I'll condemn the Iranians for that.